War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Key Battles of the War of 1812. This is your host, James Early, as always. In our last episode, we followed Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, down into the South, and we looked at the events of what are known as the Creek War, certainly had a lot of effect on the War of 1812 in general. Very bloody episode, very bloody campaign on both sides. A lot of really fierce fighting and atrocities, we would say today, committed by both sides. And then we also looked at the British attempt to take the war to another part of the United States that had not seen much of the war before, and that was the Chesapeake area. We saw how Admiral Cockburn went and burned and took prisoners and set enslaved people free and just did everything he could to cause trouble for the Americans living up and down the Chesapeake area. So the war in the South was our basic theme from last time. This time, what we're going to do is we're going to push pause on the narrative of the military campaigns, and we're going to look at the experience of the common soldier. What was it like to be a soldier in the War of 1812? How did you get recruited? What was your pay? What happened to people who deserted or defected to the other side? What did they eat? What did they drink? What kind of supplies did they have? What was discipline like? What was combat like? What did you actually do in a battle? And what happened if you were taken prisoner? So those are some issues we're going to look at in this episode. I think you'll find it very interesting. Instead of talking about generals and admirals and politicians, we're going to look at just average private soldiers or sergeants or maybe lower officers. What was their life like? I am joined again, as I have been throughout this series and hopefully will be throughout the entire series, by my friend Steve Guerra. Steve, are you ready for this?
I'm ready. I'm excited to take a little step outside of the narrative and take a look at some of these more, I guess you might say, common issues. Some of the things that are the underlying concerns, you might say. I guess let's start off with recruits and pay and what did it look like for the common soldier?
Sounds like a plan. As we know, when the United States decided to declare war on the greatest military superpower in the world, they were not ready, not even close. The army was tiny, the navy was tiny, and the pay was basically garbage. The U.S. Army only paid an enlistment bonus at the beginning of the war of $16 per month and a salary. I'm sorry, the bonus was $16 just one time. That's just like a signing bonus. You get $16. Woohoo, I'm rich. And a salary of $5 per month. $5 per month. In today's money, that would be much more, of course, but it would still be a pathetically low amount. The $5 per month is about half of what a common laborer made. So you could actually make more money just, you know, sweeping floors or working on a farm than you could joining the army. And this, of course, made recruiting very difficult. Yay, I'm going to sign up for the army. I'm going to take a pay cut and endure all the other privations. So over time, the U.S. Congress and the government is going to sweeten the deal somewhat. They started giving land grants of 160 acres, but this interested few potential recruits, most of whom wanted cash. I don't want land, I want money. British privates, by the way, made even less than American ones. To make up for the lack of recruits into the regular army, Madison's administration tried calling up militia. And we've talked about this before. Militia were poorly equipped, poorly trained, poorly disciplined. They often refused to cross state or national lines, and many deserted. In combat, militia frequently threw down their arms and ran. In 1813, the U.S. government raised the enlistment bonus to $40 and the monthly pay to $8. This helped bring in more recruits, but it was still not enough. Further increases in 1814 again brought more recruits, but again, the number of them was insufficient. Now, American officers were not really much better at their jobs than enlisted men. Most had little or no military experience, and few had been in combat. Officers tended to obsess over rank, honor, and personal prestige, and dueling among officers was rampant, and little was done to stop dueling. So American officers end up killing other American officers. That's really great. Pay for American soldiers was often late. Some soldiers went weeks or even months without being paid. And this is a very interesting thing. You don't see this in every war. You don't see it in a lot of wars, at least not in the modern period. But both sides tried to entice soldiers on the other side to defect. More British soldiers defected to the U.S. Army or to American militia units than vice versa. However, American units lost more deserters. Most of these American deserters just simply went home. They didn't join the British side. A few did, but most did not. So isn't that interesting, Steve, that you had the British Army trying to recruit American soldiers into their army and the American Army and militia units trying to recruit British soldiers into their units? So there was a lot of crossing sides.
It makes a lot of sense if you're wanting, you can get a deserter and you're basically getting a fully trained person that you don't have to pay for training. They can just come in and start doing the job. You don't have to, the British, they were taking people. I think their army recruitment was kind of questionable, just like their naval recruitment. And yes, the American, so you're getting somebody who's maybe somewhat motivated to be there. It doesn't sound like a bad strategy in theory.
Yeah, you raise a good point, because a lot of the British Army, is just like the Navy, were conscripts. They were not there of their own will. And so they don't really have very high morale. They don't have a lot of reason to fight. And so naturally, if they can get out of there, why not? Why not join the Americans? Why not start a new life in America? It was seen as a land of opportunity. And to many people, it was a land of opportunity. British pay was horrible, as I mentioned earlier. British discipline was extremely severe. So they figured, I'll run the risk. You know, maybe I can join the U.S. Army or just run off and work on a farm somewhere and nobody will ask questions. They spoke the same language. They fit in real well. It makes a lot of sense.
I think there's a lot here, too, of the modern military that they don't pay very well. And like you said, they're making about half of the pay of a common laborer. And they have some benefits of land and food. We'll get into that. There was food provided and that sort of thing. But you're talking about if somebody can, you can join the army, make half as much as you could just sweeping floors, and you potentially have to go get killed, not get paid, be in the middle of nowhere. You're not going to drag in the person who's even a skilled laborer. Why would they take a 75% pay cut to do that sort of thing? So you're really just either hoping that times are bad and that is joining the military is a better option than maybe not working. You're just maybe not taking from the greatest human resources pool, you might say.
Right. I mean, you did have a few Americans, maybe half or so. There's no way to come up with an exact percentage, but there were the true believers, you know, that wanted to go fight for their country and get glory and honor for themselves and to drive away the British or maybe even take British land. But that would be a minority. You're right. A lot of people joined the army for economic reasons, even though the pay was so bad. But for some people, they didn't have work. So that was the only work that they could get, was being in the army. At least in the army, you get semi-regular pay, you get semi-regular food. But you're right. A lot of the best and the brightest would stay behind and find other ways to contribute to the war effort, or they would pay for a substitute, which was, that was a big problem during the Civil War, and it was an issue in this war as well.
And as in a military command structure, you want the career soldiers, because that's what the army's really created around, is the high-ranking enlisted men and the high-ranking officers who have built up that institutional knowledge. And that's tough to maintain when the pay is so bad.
Yes, definitely.
Then moving on, one of their benefits, I guess you could say, is that there was food and drink and they got supplies, but there was also punishment that went along with that.
Yeah, and the food and drink was often not regular in coming. This is a problem faced by many armies throughout history. American soldiers were often short on food, clothing, and other supplies. It wasn't quite as bad as it was during most of the Revolutionary War, but it was still bad at times. The small number of farms and the sparsely populated American lands near the border with Canada could not feed the U.S. forces. Most supplies had to be transported from the American heartland to the soldiers in the Northern Theater. And as we've said before, and we're going to continue to say, overland travel was extremely slow and perilous given the poor state of American roads in 1812. Sending supplies by river was quicker and more efficient, although it was not always easy. Historian Alan Taylor, in his excellent book, The Civil War of 1812, writes this, quote, "Interrupted by rapids and portages, obstructed by ice in winter, swollen to floods in the spring, and sometimes falling too low in late summer, the upper reaches of the rivers proved erratic for transportation." Talk about a supply chain crisis, Steve.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We think we have one now, but it was nothing compared to back then. Now, a soldier's standard daily ration consisted of 1.2 pounds, 1.25 pounds of salted beef, or 0.75 pounds of pork, 18 ounces of bread or flour, 1 gill, which is 5 ounces of whiskey. That's the most important part of the ration, of course, the whiskey. For every 100 rations, 2 quarts of salt, 4 quarts of vinegar, 4 pounds of soap, and 1.5 pounds of candles were supposed to be provided. Keyword there is supposed to be. Rather than directly provision its troops, the U.S. government entrusted the task of supplying the men to private contractors. Now, some of these contractors were honest and did their jobs well, but many others, after being paid by the government, gave the Army rations that were less than promised or of poor quality. Meat was often spoiled, vegetables and fruits virtually non-existent, and flour was rotten or adulterated with plaster of Paris, dirt, chalk, ashes, or burnt bones. Some contractors simply failed to deliver any supplies. I shouldn't laugh, but that's just, it's horribly awful.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Oh, man. So the food was not good in a lot of cases. And the difficulty in getting supplies to American soldiers and the corruption in the contractor system led to widespread disease and death. One American officer wrote, quote, "My brave men are in a wretched condition at present. Numbers are barefooted and no clothing to cover their skins from the cold winds of the north. Numbers of them are very sickly and several dead. I dread the consequences when I see the way we are clothed and fed." End of quote. General Jacob Brown wrote this, quote, "Five men have perished by diseases to one who has fallen by the sword," end quote. British soldiers, on the other hand, were generally well supplied due to the effectiveness of the St. Lawrence River as a supply route. Even when the river froze, supplies could be transported by sled. And as I touched upon a minute ago, alcohol, particularly whiskey, was cheap and abundant. It was part of a soldier's ration, and commanders would often give extra out as a reward or withhold it as punishment. Recruiters used it to get potential recruits inebriated so that they would join the army. Soldiers in the field often became drunk, making attempts to maintain discipline very difficult. One American officer wrote this, quote, "Soldiers are daily seen drunk in the streets, and even non-commissioned officers commanding guards have been found intoxicated and staggering through the town during their tour of duty," end of quote. Not good. The Army's failure to feed, clothe, and pay the troops motivated many to desert. During the war, about 5,000 American soldiers deserted. This is about 13% of the total. 13% of American forces deserted, compared to 3% that died in combat and 8% that died of disease. As we said earlier, British soldiers also deserted fairly often. If they were caught, they were often whipped with a cat of nine tails. Of course, I think everybody probably knows what that is, but if you don't, it's a whip, which at the end you had these individual strands. There would be nine of them, and often there would be a little piece of metal or a piece of bone at the end of each one of these tails. So it's kind of like being whipped with nine whips at the same time instead of one. And 300 lashes, 300 was the standard punishment. Oh, Steve, makes my back hurt just thinking about it.
Yeah, that's brutal.
Yeah, and they would often, like, men would pass out, say, after 100 lashes. And if that happened, they would take the poor guy and just kind of lay him down. And later, when they were revived and able to stand up again, then they would get the rest of the punishment. You know, they didn't just say, oh, okay, well, he passed out after 100, so that's enough, no more. Oh, no, 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 no. They were going to definitely give him the full punishment. And again, that's why so many British people deserted. Punishments were just barbaric.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the American Army, interestingly enough, flogging was banned in 1812. So does that mean that American deserters got off easy? Oh, no, 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 no. They were instead publicly shamed, which, you know, that I could handle, but more often than not, they endured a punishment called cobbling. To be cobbled meant that you had your buttocks, to use Forrest Gump's pronunciation, your rear end would be beaten with a rod. And it would, of course, be, you know, bared. It would be your bare butt that would get beaten by this rod. As the war went on and desertions continued, despite these punishments, American commanders increasingly resorted to executing deserters. Executions rose from just 3 in 1812 to 32 in 1813 and 143 in 1814. And in just the first 6 weeks of 1815, another 24 American soldiers were executed, bringing the total number of Americans executed in the war to 205.
And that's a 205. There were some battles where 205 people weren't killed.
Yeah, exactly. That's over several years, but still, killing your own people, not the best way to win a war.
There's a lot to unpack here. I think one thing that's interesting is how intoxicated people were back then, constantly. Even kids didn't generally, they would drink, they'd call it small beer, but it was still alcoholic beer, 2-3% beer. And that's, men wouldn't drink that because that was for kids. Men would drink whiskey or
hard cider,
rum, you know, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Just life was just so difficult. I mean, we've seen how much disease there was, how brutal people would be to each other, how harsh punishments were for very trivial crimes in some cases. And one way people dealt with it was lots and lots of alcohol. Today, people go to therapy, but they didn't really have that back then, as far as I know. So, yeah, and I've read in several sources that the average American consumed 7 gallons of alcohol per year, 7 gallons.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that includes, you know, kids and stuff too in the average. So you think a lot of adults are consuming way more than 7 gallons. And it was mainly hard liquor, as you mentioned. It was whiskey, it was rum, it was hard cider, other things. Whereas today, the average American consumes maybe 3 gallons a year, and it's mainly beer and wine.
Did the Army brand deserters in the face like they did it later on?
Not as far as I've been able to tell. I'm not saying it never happened, but that was a practice that was mainly Mexican-American War, Civil War. As I mentioned earlier, the main punishment for deserting was, on the British side, it would be flogging. On the American side, it would be this cobbling, the beating. And then later, as we saw, they would just shoot them or hang them.
I mean, as brutal as it sounds, it's kind of logical in a way, in that the Army needed some way to know. You know, they didn't have dishonorable discharges and things to punish people who were deserters, who were somehow fallen in their duties to the Army and doing these things. They didn't want somebody deserting and then just going to another recruitment station to get their $16 and then go back into the Army. I guess they needed some sort of mechanism to signal that these people were deserters, were not following the rules.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors. Yeah, exactly. That's why they came up with that later, even though it was a very brutal and like harsh. That word brutal keeps coming up, doesn't it? Harsh.
Yeah.
This is not a good time to be alive.
No, it sure isn't. And speaking of that, what did combat look like?
Oh, yeah. Speaking of another thing you don't want to go through. Oh, man. It just keeps getting worse. All right. To be a good soldier, one has to be willing to be disciplined, to submit to orders, and to live a regimented life. But few Americans were willing to do this. Some things never change, Steve. I think today, few Americans are willing to do this.
Yeah.
But in 1812, very few Americans had any real military experience. If they did, they were I'm talking about on the ground. Of course, the situation was totally different in among naval personnel. They'd had a lot, naval personnel had a lot of military experience, as we've seen from some of these previous naval wars. But again, I'm focusing here on infantry and artillery and ground, just ground combat in general. If you had military experience, by definition, you were very old because the revolution had been over for, what, almost 30 years. Many Americans had served in the militia, but again, the militia was more of a social club than a serious military organization. Drill, training, and discipline were nearly absent. It bears repeating. By contrast, most British soldiers were battle-hardened veterans of the campaigns against France. British soldiers were much more likely to obey orders from their superiors than Americans were. Armies in 1812 consisted mainly of infantry who were supported by much smaller numbers of artillery and dragoons, which were kind of like cavalry, but they mainly acted as scouts and couriers. And although some foot soldiers carried rifles, which were relatively accurate and had a fairly long range, most carried smoothbore muskets. Smoothbore muskets were less accurate and they had shorter range. You may wonder, why didn't everybody use a rifle? Well, rifles were expensive, they were slow to load, they were prone to jam, and they could not have a bayonet attached. The technology of small arms in 1812 had not changed much since the Revolutionary War. The guns or the rifles, the muskets that were used were flintlocks, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. An experienced soldier could fire about 3 or 4 shots a minute. That's it. Infantry tactics were also virtually unchanged from the Revolutionary War. Soldiers stood in close ranks and fired coordinated volleys. After the two sides exchanged several volleys, usually one side would fix bayonets and charge the other side. British soldiers especially loved bayonet charges, especially because they frightened American militia and raw recruits. During battle, soldiers had to deal with the kickback of their muskets, which often bruised their cheek and shoulder. There was also deafening noise, particularly if artillery was in use, and smoke, not to mention bullets and shrapnel flying around. Some soldiers in panic did not ram their cartridges all the way down. Others rendered their musket useless by throwing their ramrod away or by firing it away with a bullet. Still others, particularly militia, as we've seen, simply broke and ran.
Can you maybe explain what this flintlock technology is?
Sure. A flintlock is a musket. It uses a 75 caliber bullet. It's smoothbore, muzzle-loading, single shot. Let me break all that down. So had a 3.5-foot long barrel with no rifling. In other words, the inside of the barrel was smooth. There were no grooves cut in, so they weren't able to give the bullet a spin. The maximum range was about 80 yards, and the muzzle velocity was relatively low. And I said it was muzzle loading. That means it had to be loaded from the muzzle, the business end. You stick it in the end of the barrel, not in the breech, the other end that's closer to the trigger. It was 75 caliber. The ball was round. It was about 1/2 inch in diameter. When it entered a human body, it crushed bones and tore up muscle and organs. You know, it didn't just, today's bullets are very high velocity. And oftentimes, if they don't hit you in a vital organ, you'll survive because it'll just go in and out really quickly. Not these. They would go in, they would flatten sometimes, as I said, just crush bones, tear up internal tissue. They were single shot. The soldier had to empty a paper cartridge into the muzzle. So you had to, each soldier carried a case or kind of a leather box with all these cartridges, and they were made out of paper. You would pull it out, you would tear it open with your teeth, you would put some powder into the muzzle, then you would drop the ball in, which is on the other side of the cartridge, and then you would ram it down with a ramrod. This is all similar to Civil War rifles, but here's the difference. These were flintlocks. So when the trigger was pulled, this allowed a hammer with a screwed down piece of flint to strike a movable frizzen, just like a plate, a small plate. When the flint hit the frizzen, that created a spark and that ignited a small amount of gunpowder in a pan below the frizzen. The flash set off the powder in the barrel, which forced the ball out. So basically, you're starting a little fire above the little hole, and the fire would go through into the barrel, and that would shoot off the bullet with the aid of the powder. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think if you think of a Zippo lighter, when you strike it, that's just basically a frizzen and a flint.
Yeah, only this time the fire is going down, like into the barrel of the gun instead of up. Exactly. If you want to learn more about this, listeners, there's a great There's some great videos that you can look at. The American Battlefield Trust has some. Those are among my favorites. But there's others as well where people fire actual guns from this time period.
There's a lot that can go wrong there then. If the flint doesn't work right, if the frizzen isn't set just right, if the ramrod it gets lost or broken, if the gun's not cocked properly.
If the powder is wet, yeah.
So there's 10 different failure points that if any one of those goes wrong, your musket is essentially just turns into a wooden club.
Right. That's right.
I guess that's why they put bayonets with them too.
Yeah, the bayonets were, as I said earlier, very much favored by the British. That was part of their game. It was terror. Imagine if you're this militia guy, you know, you've had almost no combat experience and you see this professional army with these impressive red coats just charging across the field with a bayonet. I would run too, or at least I would be certainly tempted to. I don't know. I can't say for sure what I would do, but definitely the temptation would be to run.
I think too that, like you were saying with rifles, why not give everybody a rifle? They were extremely expensive and there weren't many places that manufactured them either.
Yeah, they were definitely not the majority of weapons that were produced at the time, for sure.
And then I had read that generally Americans throughout history did not love the bayonet like the British did. Is that true in this war as well, that they're just that the Americans didn't use the bayonets quite as much as the British?
Yeah, that is definitely true in this war. Bayonet was just kind of the British calling card. So Americans preferred to shoot and or to use artillery as good as well, and to run sometimes, as we've seen.
Yeah, like I was thinking when looking at these notes and thinking about it, that if we throw back to our four-hour series on the four-hour movie Gettysburg, when Joshua Chamberlain used a bayonet charge at Gettysburg, that was a very unusual call.
Bayonets! Yes. Yes. Oh, man. You're going to get me sidetracked on the Gettysburg. I could talk about that all day. But but yeah, it was. It was definitely not your typical thing that would be done at the time. Neither side really was enamored a whole lot with bayonets or even hand-to-hand combat, but they did use them on occasion.
Now we can get into this issue of prisoners. There were a lot of prisoners being taken, and prisoners of war is always a complicated topic in any conflict.
It really is. It presents so many issues and problems and quandaries, and what other synonym can I come up for? Let me get my thesaurus out real quick, but yeah, it complicates everything so much. So both the American and British armies took many prisoners during the war. Both sides tended to send captured officers home on parole until they could be exchanged. Now, let me explain what parole means. Parole, it's different from what you think of today. Parole in military terms in the 19th century meant you send them home and they have to agree not to fight again. And some people, my students sometimes say, well, why would they do that? Why wouldn't they return to battle? And I will counter by saying, okay, you've been through a horrible campaign for the last 2 years. You've seen your buddies be killed. You've starved. You've had disease. You've suffered. Are you really going to sign up for more of that? You know, it's like most people after this, they just want to go home. And so they will. However, there were also exchanges. So there were definite rules about how you can exchange prisoners. So Steve, let's say you're British and I'm American and you have 10 privates as prisoners and I have 10 privates. Well, we might swap those one-to-one, but let's say I have 10 privates and you have a sergeant and some privates. Well, a sergeant might be worth 3 privates or 4. I don't know the exact numbers, but what if you have a captain? That might be worth 15 privates or and so on. So it's kind of like chess pieces. You know, you talk about how the queen is worth 9 and the rook is worth 5 and all that. Each rank had a value in points, if you will. And so they would be traded for that many privates. So sometimes people would be sent home on parole until they could be exchanged for another officer. That happened with Winfield Scott. Militia were sometimes sent home by the British because the British considered them to be part-time soldiers, not really very impressive. Enlisted men, however, were held as prisoners until they could be exchanged. Early in the war, Americans usually held their prisoners in state penitentiaries, while the British held them in prison ships. And those were just awful, by the way. Later, the British put many Americans in prison buildings. And we're going to see they end up taking a lot of them back to Great Britain. So what did they do with the prisoners once they had them? Each side both humiliated and tried to convert their prisoners, you know, kind of like good cop, bad cop. They tried to entice the prisoners to leave their army and join the other side. Alan Taylor writes, quote, "In that process, the British relied more on the push of prison ministry than did the Americans, who usually counted on the pull of their more prosperous society," end quote. When the British caught Americans who were born in the UK, they would refuse to parole them and they would imprison them. Those who were proven to have deserted from the British Army or Navy to join the Americans were often shot or hanged. The British did not appreciate it when somebody who had been born in the UK ended up in an American uniform or as a privateer. That was, to them, completely unacceptable. Now, as the war progressed and each side's feelings for the other became more hostile, the system of paroles and exchanges broke down. One British official explained the reasoning behind the new policy. Quote, "The best method to make the Americans tired of the war will be by keeping their relations and friends as prisoners," end quote. And in Donald Hickey's words, quote, "By early 1814, all the officers held by either side in the New World were in close confinement with the threat of retaliatory execution hanging over their heads," end quote. Between November 1812 and May 1813, the two sides tried to negotiate a series of conventions dictating how prisoners had to be treated, but they could not agree on the terms, and so no agreement was reached. And by January 1814, the U.S. held about 1,700 British prisoners, while the British held 4,300 Americans captive. Some of the American prisoners were seamen that had been impressed before the war. Now, why did the Americans have so many fewer prisoners? Part of the reason is because of privateers did not like taking prisoners. Prisoners wasted valuable cargo space that could be taken up by valuable goods. To increase the number of prisoners of war held by the U.S., Congress in March 1814 authorized a bounty of $100 for every British captive brought into the U.S. by a privateer. This bounty, however, only brought about 700 prisoners. The British were infuriated by this bounty, which they basically saw as kidnapping. In retaliation, British forces began taking captives during their raids on the Chesapeake. So things are getting ugly. Again, it's spiraling out of control. In late 1813, General Prevost up in Canada, realizing he could not feed his prisoners, began shipping them to England. Many of these ended up in the infamous Dartmoor prison in Devon. By December 1813, Dartmoor held about 5,300 Americans, which was about 75% of all American prisoners held by the British. Alan Taylor describes Dartmoor thus. So imagine this, you're in this prison, you're some poor guy that was not drafted because they didn't do conscription, but you joined the militia and you ended up marching into Canada and then you get captured and then you get put on a ship and you're sent to England and you end up in this prison. Here's how Alan Taylor describes it. This is a long quote, but definitely worth it. Quote, "James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors. 15 miles from the channel, the prison lay on a barren mountain above a treeless moor cloaked in fog or swept by cold winds and driving rains. Two stone walls, 14 feet high, circled an inner stockade of tall iron stakes. Within this triple barrier lay a compound of 7 stone prisons, each 3 stories tall, 180 feet long and 40 wide, with gray slate roofs. Within each prison, the men slept stacked in hammocks within open galleries. Although dank, cold, and depressing, Dartmoor was bigger, less crowded, and better managed than other prisons. The chief plight of the prisoners was the tedium and suspense of prolonged captivity. Day after dreary day, Dartmoor seemed to become their eternal fate and their early grave." Pretty, not a fun way to spend your time, huh, Steve?
No, that's for sure.
Oh, man. Prisoners were poorly fed at Dartmoor and at other American prisons. That is British prisons that held Americans. Prisoners on both sides were often deprived of warm clothes. Disease, of course, was common in British prisons, but not as much as in American prisons. British hospitals in general were cleaner, warmer, and better than were prisons in the U.S. Despite this, however, Americans in general treated their captives better than the British did. American jailers often let their prisoners work for wages at nearby farms and to live with their employees. At one prison, Pittsfield in New York State, the 1,300 inmates were the best fed and clothed of any prisoners on either side. Again, here's Alan Taylor. He says regarding this, the prisoners in this Pittsfield prison, quote, "Free to move about the town, the officers rode horses and played cricket, quoits, billiards, football, and whist. They also flew kites, went fishing, attended sermons, read books and newspapers, and debated politics." End of quote. And you can see what the Americans are doing here, right, Steve? They're killing them with kindness. And as you will not be surprised to hear, many of these Pittsfield prisoners never returned to their units, preferring to stay in America.
I mean,
how about that? Isn't that crazy? Just interesting stuff. Fascinating.
I mean, that's a vacation people pay for. Hang out in the Catskills, play cards,
yeah,
fly kites.
And whist and quoits. I don't even know what quoits is. It sounds better than being in Dartmoor, you know, sitting around doing nothing and dying of disease.
I think that for me, that gets back to the point that even if you have the very best of intentions to take care of the prisoners of war in the most humane way possible, look at what they're doing, how much they're paying and how they're treating their actual soldiers. What do you think is going to be left over for prisoners of war who they really don't want?
Yeah, that happens in a lot of wars where, you know, the original, especially back in the early part of the American experience, you think, well, we're going to just exchange the prisoners, well, or parole them. We won't have to have prisoner of war camps. But inevitably, in every war, a lot of bad blood builds up over time. And you do have, you have like a building that's meant to hold, say, 1,000 people, and it ends up with 10,000, 20,000. That happened a lot during the Civil War as well. And you just can't manage that many people. You can't treat people humanely if they're crammed in like sardines and you don't have enough food to take care of them. There's no medicine. There's not enough blankets and so on. So yeah, it just inevitably it turns into a disaster.
Yeah. And that's thinking if you're trying to do the best and there was plenty of people who did not want to give the best, you know, sadistic people who either wanted to, you know, just make it hard on people for fun or because they hated the enemy. You can see how things like that would get out of control really quickly.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
And speaking of it getting out of control really quickly, can tell us a little bit about the 23.
The 23. Yeah, this is a fascinating story of tit for tat, and or more than tit for tat. Like, you take a pound of flesh, I'll take two from you, and so on. So here's what happened. In November of 1812, the British Army sent 23 American prisoners who were believed to be Irish to London for trial. We have to keep in mind that Ireland at this time was a fully integrated part of the United Kingdom. It was under British control, unlike today where you have Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, but then you have the Republic of Ireland, which is completely independent. So there were a lot of Irish that served in the British Army, but as you can imagine, they didn't have any love for the British. They did it mainly just so they could have a job and regular meals and things like that. So here's these 23 American prisoners. They're supposedly Irish. And again, they might have been Irish. They were Irish Americans. They were originally from Ireland, but they had served in the US military. But that's not how the British government sees it. Once you're British, you're always British. They don't believe in changing your nationality. So they get sent to London, these 23, and President Madison is not real happy about this. So, I mean, the presumption is that they're going to be convicted of treason and executed. So this is, even though they hadn't even been tried yet, it's very clear what the British are wanting to do here. They're wanting to make an example of these guys. So the following May, 1813, President Madison ordered General Henry Dearborn to imprison 23 British prisoners in retaliation. There you go. Eye for an eye, right, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
Take 23 of my guys. I'm taking 23 of yours. Well, the British said, okay, fine. We'll take 46 more. We're going to double that. You know, it's kind of like when you're playing poker. I'll see your five and raise you 10. So now you have 46 imprisoned Americans against the 23 held by the British, held by the Americans. It's getting complicated. I think that's a total of 69 now Americans. You got the original 23 and now these new 46. And the British threatened to execute two Americans for every one British hostage executed by the Americans. So Madison says, okay, fine. I'll see your 46. He ordered 46 more British officers in particular, to be held as hostages against the 46 held by the British. 2 months later, General Prevost took all remaining American officers who were prisoners as hostages. He also sent another 59 American prisoners to London for trial as traitors. So this is, again, spiraling out of control. In retaliation for this, the Americans declared another 160 prisoners to be hostages. And the British, can you guess what they did? they took more. They brought their total of hostages to 248. They took another 160. So now you've got 248 Americans who are being held as hostages against these 200 or so British hostages that are being held by the Americans. Finally, American General William Winder, who himself was a prisoner at the time, negotiated a deal with British officials that all the hostages except the original 23 held by the Americans and the original 46 held by the British would be released. So finally, things kind of, the situation is diffused, a little bit of detente here. Then in July, both sides agreed to return all the remaining hostages to the status of regular prisoners.
I mean, that is a brutal, brutal story.
Yeah.
And you can really see how everything just turns so nasty so quickly in this conflict.
Yeah, we've seen this all throughout the conflict. We saw this in the wars in the South, the Creek War, as well as the raids on the Chesapeake. It's just kind of like, well, all right, so you did something bad to me. Well, I'll show you. I'm going to do something even worse. It's like, let's see if we can up the ante on cruelty and outdo the other side. You can see why, when we were talking about prisoners earlier, why there was less and less a desire to parole these prisoners or exchange them. You know, instead, we're just going to make them suffer.
You could really see a totally different situation come out. I mean, you can always play the if game, but I mean, just practically speaking, if something like this had gone through, the relations between the United States, British Canada, eventually just Canada, and then the British could have been taken a very different turn after this conflict.
Yeah, and really, relations between the United States and Britain are going to be decidedly cool, shall we say, not particularly warm. They're not going to be hostile. There won't be enemies, but there will be threats of war in the future. Although, fortunately, we're not going to go to war against the UK again, but you're not really going to have what I would consider a friendly and a warm relationship until the late 1800s, early 1900s, when we finally develop what is known as the special relationship, the very close tie between the UK and the US. But that we're far from that right now. We're you can see things are, as we've said, it's just the relationship is getting worse and worse. Both sides are wanting to really punish the other side for the most part.
And it's kind of interesting that things didn't stay so hot afterwards, but I guess that's a different story for a different day.
Yeah, we'll
do that. Cool is probably the best outcome.
Yeah, very, you know, cool. Yeah, cool is about the best you could hope for. Not directly hostile. We're not fighting each other, but we don't love each other either.
Yeah, so we've gotten a little taste of what the common soldier went through, and it doesn't give us very much hope to put our and happiness to put our hang our hats on.
Right. It gives us a real appreciation for what these poor guys suffered through. You know, I have an ancestor who fought in the War of 1812. He's my third great grandfather.
Oh, wow.
And he died during the war, probably of disease. I'm not 100% sure. His name was William Early. He was born in 1776 and died, I believe, in 1813. So yeah, I kind of have a personal connection to this. I think of my great, great, great granddaddy, you know, slogging around, carrying that big musket and suffering from disease and lack of food, lack of clothing and all that. It's just, it gives you an appreciation again for what our ancestors suffered through. And it makes us thankful that we are not going through that right now.
Do you know any of the details, where he was from, where he fought?
He was born in Virginia, but that's all I know. I've got to do some more research.
Oh, that's a fascinating. You might have a little sidetrack in there if you're super motivated.
Maybe so. We'll see. All right. Well, I think you got anything else, Steve?
No, besides the key earlies in battle of history, American history.
Early's in the battle of, yeah, I also had ancestors in the Civil War, but we'll save that for another time. All right. So, Lister, I hope you enjoyed this look into the life of a common soldier. And on both sides, we talk more about the American side, of course, because we are Americans and we know more about it. But in our next episode, we're going to resume the narrative of the battles, and we are going to go back up to the North again, and we're going to see how the Americans fare in their third major campaign to attack Canada. You got to give it to the Americans, Steve. They refuse to give up, right?
Yeah. What is this, third time? Will that be the charm, or are the fourth time? It's hard to...
In fact, that's what the name of the episode is, Third Time's the Charm with a question mark. And will it work this time, or will it be another ignominious defeat? Join us next time and you will find out. We'll see you then. Take care. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen, and Vlogging Through History by Chris Mowry. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you could join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Anna Concepcion Castro, Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabrese, Alex Coombs, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Mike Rollison, David Santee, and Michael Severino. And to Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Roger Douglas, Scott Hendricks, Hoosier Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.